I'm Peggy Clark, and welcome to The Bridge. The Bridge brings wise women and a few good men of different generations together into revelatory conversation about what matters most. The Bridge is a project of the Aspen Institute, a nonpartisan forum for values-based leadership and the exchange of ideas. Today, I'm joined in conversation with two champions of women's rights globally. Our discussion touches on their efforts to combat gender-based violence in child marriage and increase educational and economic opportunities for women. What lessons can women in the United States learn from the fights African women have waged? Joy Pumafi is an advocate for women and families and a public sector leader in Africa and globally. She served as a member of parliament in Botswana and then became the country's minister of health. She went on to lead family and community health at the World Health Organization and then served as VP of human development at the World Bank. She's currently the executive secretary of the Africa Leaders Malaria Alliance, and I've had the pleasure of working very closely with Joy as the chair of our Aspen Global Leaders Council for Reproductive Health and a number of other projects. Welcome, Joy. So happy to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Peggy. It's wonderful to participate in this podcast with you, and it's always a pleasure to work with you.
And we're also joined today with Sesonge Msimang, who's a South African writer and advocate for gender equality and health policy. She fought and worked for the needs of African girls affected by HIV/AIDS and then served as executive director of the Open Society Initiative for Southern Africa. She's a frequent New York Times writer on women's issues, and she directs the Center for Stories. Welcome, Sesonge.
Thanks so much, Peggy. It's great to be here.
Great. Wonderful. So let's dive in. As you know, a focus of The Bridge is conversations across generations. But defining what generation you're from is sometimes blurry and a little hard to do. But Joy, could you kick us off here by telling us how would you describe what generation you're from and what defines your generation?
I come from the post-independence generation in Africa. You know, most of the African countries got independence in the 60s. So we were coming in at a time when Africa was either in the process of attaining independence or had just gotten independent. And so we were, you know, the first generation of the first wave of human development on the African continent.
And Sesonge, what about you? How would you describe what generation you're from?
I guess I'm part of the generation that were Mandela's children. So very much becoming a young adult when Nelson Mandela was released from jail in the early 1990s. And my generation of young South Africans was very much defined by sort of nation building in that time. But also, I suppose, in many ways, part of a global generation. So the first generation of South Africans who were both inward looking and also finally open to the world. So bit of a global generation.
Great. Would you consider yourself a millennial, or are you the
I'm too
next
old.
Generation?
Mm-hmm. I'm slightly too old to be a millennial. Although I can relate to many things that millennials go through, because I think the influence of technology in my life and kind of screens and all of that stuff has been significant. So I've lived longer with it than I have without it. So it's been a defining feature of my generation, but I certainly look at some millennials and feel very old.
Mm-hmm. And you were born in South Africa.
I wasn't.
You wasn't.
I was born in exile.
Were born in exile.
Born in exile, raised in exile, and came home for the first time to visit when Nelson Mandela was released from jail.
And how old were you then?
I was 17 when he was released from jail, yes.
And Joy, were you born in Botswana?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was born, late 50s, before independence. My first classroom was under a tree. So when we came out of independence, when we had less than 10 university graduates, we were in the whole country, you know, in 1966. We were looked upon as the first generation that was going to really get, you know, properly educated. So born, bred in Botswana.
So interesting, the first generation to be properly educated.
So, you know, it's really thrilling for me to be sitting here today having a conversation with both of you who inspire me so much, really, every day and every time I interact with both of you. And both of you have fought for a long time for the rights of women and girls. And we find ourselves at kind of an interesting moment right now in terms of gender justice and the global women's movement. Joy, can you start first by telling me, how would you describe this moment that we're in terms of the global women's issues and rights issues?
I would say that it is a moment of opportunity. It's a moment of opportunity because we still have huge challenges. It is estimated that Africa loses about $100 billion in potential growth and development every year because we are not taking advantage of the other 50% of our population. But I would say it's an era of opportunity because we have seen how much we are able to achieve as a global community by fully engaging women. And so we have a choice now about whether we are going to fully harness this huge potential that exists for all of us, or whether we can let it go. So I see it as an opportunity, but also a huge challenge, because what the past 50 years has taught us is that, since Africa became independent, is that it is not easy effecting this change. People are scared of change. People, do not want to lose the influence that they have, particularly the other 50% of the population. So it's not going to be easy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. No, that's helpful. And Sasanke, what about you? How would you describe this moment for women's rights?
So I very much agree. I think that it's important to remain optimistic even in the face of significant challenges. And it's a very challenging moment. So I think in the last 20 years, if I look back on my own career and the things that I've done, I think if you think about South Africa, there has been tremendous progress on a whole range of women's rights issues, whether it's new laws on gender-based violence, access to being able to terminate pregnancies, whether it's getting more women into senior positions in the private sector and in the public sector. South Africa is in the top five countries in terms of women parliamentarians, so public leadership. So tremendous gains. And I think with great success often comes a great backlash. And so the challenging part of this moment is the backlash. And it's in many ways a very organized backlash. It's a backlash we see globally, not just in South Africa. In a range of countries, you see that institutions that are opposed to women's equality and individuals who are opposed to women's equality are becoming very organized with their arguments, with their resources, in pushing back against the gains that we've had. So it's a moment to hold fast and to be very, very optimistic, because if we aren't optimistic, I fear that we sort of drown in feeling overwhelmed by the challenges.
You're listening to The Bridge, a podcast by the Aspen Institute. I'm Peggy Clark. Today, I'm speaking with two champions of women's rights globally, Joy Pumafi and Sisonge Msimang. If you like today's show, please find our first episode, The Women's Movement Redux. It features journalists Courtney Martin and Pat Mitchell in conversation about women's rights in the United States and how they may change in a new political atmosphere. Their conversation also touches on family and career. Find it by searching The Bridge from the Aspen Institute on iTunes. Now back to my conversation with Joy Pumapi and Sisonge Msimang. Our discussion was held earlier this month prior to the Women's March on Washington on January 21st. So let's turn to talking about something else. Certainly in the U.S.,
the issue of reproductive rights has once again taken center stage, and many of us feel that we will lose a lot of the ground that we have achieved in terms of reproductive rights, both in the U.S. as well as globally. So let's talk for a moment about how each of you personally have experienced this. So Joy, when were you first aware of the fragility or the importance of reproductive rights in your own life?
I became aware of it at high school because, you know, a lot of my colleagues were being taken out of school in order to get married. This is children who were 14, 15, 16, would be pulled out of school so that they can go and get married. And by the time I finished my university, a lot of my colleagues whom I was with when I was at lower secondary school or lower high school already had six, seven, you know, children. So this is when I first became aware of the importance of family planning. And family planning not just as a way of preventing pregnancy, but as a way of enhancing the quality of life. And that's when I realized how important it was to have an education first, to have a means of making a living first before you start having children. And then the contribution of education to you know, the decision making process about, you know, when to have a child, how many children you should have, and therefore also giving you the capacity to be able to support those children. So I would say it was from an early age, but it has been a very, very powerful lesson for me that I have carried, you know, throughout my professional life.
Mm. Good. That's helpful, Joy. And Sisonke, what about you? When were you first aware of the whole question of reproductive rights?
Well, I'm just reflecting on the response that that May has just provided, because I mean, 20 years later for myself, you know, as a college student, certainly my peers in high school, the issue of pregnancy and family planning was less poignant. But by university, I would say that a pretty significant proportion of my cohorts and I, we're very grateful for access to family planning services and for access to contraceptives, but also for access to termination of pregnancy services. And so thinking about the way that the climate in America has changed, I went to university here in America, and thinking about the way the climate has changed and the attacks on Planned Parenthood, I mean, were it not for those services, you know, when I was in college, I think I would have a very different life. So I think, for me, when I think not as much about development questions and challenges, which are, of course, you know, important, as has just been outlined, I think about the politics of reproductive health and rights and what's at stake. And I think there are several things at stake. One is that, of course, every woman has a right to decide how, when, where she will or will not have children. But that the other is that those decisions ought not to be made by a state, and they ought not to be made by a partner. Where a woman can and wants to make those decisions with their partner, that's great. But I think we're entering an era in which, again, both in America and in many parts of the world, those choices are shrinking for women. Violent partners make decisions about whether or when women are going to have children. And violence against women has become increasingly a problem that, you know, I live in Australia. It's a huge and significant problem that has implications not just for women's lives at a physical level, but also about the choices they make about having children. And then states infringing upon those rights continually. So when I go back to this idea of what a challenging moment, that when we make gains, I think it's very important for us to understand that those gains are not necessarily there to stay, that they have to be fought for, they have to be preserved, they have to be pushed forward. And reproductive rights, I think, is in some ways is a crucible.
So you mentioned to me that one of the first acts that Nelson Mandela undertook was to legalize abortion. Is that accurate in South Africa?
So definitely one of the first acts of the new government, a post-apartheid government, was the Choice on Termination of Pregnancy Act. I think that many women's rights activists in South Africa would take exception to the idea that it was one of Nelson Mandela's first acts, because we had to push him as we had to push all of those male leaders, because you know, he's maybe known as a saint to many of us around the world. But like all leaders, decisions are made on the basis of resistance, of pushing, of cajoling. And so one of the first acts of the new South African parliament was to take away the ban on abortions and to allow all South African women to have access to termination, safe and free terminations. One of the most confronting and troubling realities of the new South Africa is that a very high percentage of South African women are not aware that abortion is legal. And so we have a very high mortality rate due to unsafe terminations. So again, it's a very important illustration of the fact that just because you've won part of the battle doesn't mean you've won the war. So there's a lot to do in terms of implementing that.
All right, great. Sasanke, thanks for sharing that with us. So let's turn a little bit to talking about the women's movement. And I think both of you know our first BRID podcast was with two women leaders from the U.S., and you are a second Bridge podcast, and we're talking about your own experiences in Africa and also globally. And, you know, for me, when the women's movement was founded in the 70s, it felt very much like a global movement. And the first international conference was in Mexico in 1974, and then the next one 10 years later in Nairobi was in 1984, and then the next one in 1994 was in Beijing. And I recently, Joy, you may remember the logo of that conference. I recently saw it again, and it was this, I can still see it. It was a sort of a dove and had a peace sign inside of it. And we very much felt that we were part of a global women's movement. But we've come a long way from those years. And here we are at this different movement where, you know, next week, millions of women will be marching on Washington to express their support for women's rights. So I want to ask both of you, what we can learn from each other, and specifically the question of what can the U.S. learn from the women's movement in Africa, and what would it take to engage a truly global movement right now? Let's start with you, Joy.
I would say, in a sense, Sasanke has been, you know, talking about exactly this. I mean, the response to this question, because I think the most important lesson that I have learned is that it doesn't end. I mean, the pursuit of equity does not end, or the addressing of inequities, because in Botswana, for example, we have got equal access to education, from basic education up to university. So it's not that there is no longer inequity in access to education. But domestic violence is on the increase. There is no reduction in domestic violence. In fact, it's on the increase. And the abortion laws continue to be very, very rigid. We are still losing a lot of young girls to abortion. Even though women occupy positions of authority in terms of middle management, and in the private sector, even senior management levels, in the public sector, that is not the case, including in politics and in parliament. Out of a parliament of, you know, about 65 now, I think, members of parliament, there are less than 10 women. I think there are something like six or seven women in that parliament. So the voice of women is still not being heard, even though they have equal access to education and equal access to economic opportunities. So my feeling is that it is about a re-socialization of society as a whole. until people start thinking differently and start treating women differently, and the attitude towards gender equity changes, education alone is not going to do it. Access to economic opportunities alone is not going to do it. So that to me is the most important lesson that we have learned, that we have to educate. The education is perhaps the most important, and not just a basic education, but re-socialization of our communities. That right. to me is the most important.
And yeah, Joy, that's really well said. Thank you for that. And do you remember those early women's gatherings, particularly in 1984, the decade of Africa, as Sasanke reminded me this morning? And do you think there's still a global women's movement?
Where I come from, it's not there anymore. I think the mistake that we made again under that movement was that we focused on access to education, demanding access to education, demanding access to land, you know, to economic opportunities. But then we didn't look at the whole spectrum of a social, economic, political authority. And because that continues to, there continues to be a gap in that area, the movement has died because the things that we have demanded for, we have sort of achieved. There has been some level of legal reform that has been born out of the Beijing Platform of Action and the pressure that the UN has been putting on countries. But it is not enough reform to actually achieve the transformation that is required. So I do agree that the movement is dying, and we do need to resurrect it, and we need to redefine it so that people can understand that it is about changing the way of life, and it is not about achieving specific milestones.
Right. That's fascinating, Joy. So let's turn to Sasanke. Mm. What do you think about where we are with the women's movement and what we can learn from you in the Africa situation?
I couldn't agree more. I think... The focus on the formal and on the technical has been to the detriment of the political. And so women's rights has become gender equality. And gender equality is something that you can measure and tick off, you know, the MDGs, Sustainable Development Goals. And so it's not to say that those aren't important, but I think the emphasis of global women's struggles has been on some of those technical UN reform type issues. And that has meant that the energy, the political energy that infused the women's movement 30, 40 years ago has been lost. And so I think the important thing for women who continue to be active around struggles in local places and who are thinking about how they connect up globally is to remember this, that the challenges that I think women in the US are facing at the moment are challenges that come from religious and cultural challenges to women's rights. So the focus on getting women into the Senate, getting girls into school, like all of those formal things are there and aren't necessarily being questioned as strongly as the cultural role and place of women, the religious pushes on whether women have a right to do this or that with their body, the shaming that we see, the letting off the hook on questions of sexuality, which then means that a rapist is not really a rapist. You know, all of those questions, if you think about the battlegrounds on which issues of women's rights are being fought in this country, they are being fought on the basis of this moral, cultural, and religious terrain. And then what that does is it filters up into questioning all the things that women can be, all the possibilities that we imagine ourselves, that we imagine for ourselves are no longer possible because we are being challenged on this terrain of morality. And I think that's something that women in Africa have obviously blatantly dealt with for many years. So we know that that's the terrain on which you have to fight. And so I think while we have been focused on the kind of, you know, the technical stuff, you still have quite a few movements in Africa where women have been for many years fighting about female genital mutilation, child marriage, all of these issues that you see very much African women championing come from this understanding that you have to tackle patriarchy where it lives, which is in culture, which is in the kind of informal institutions. So I think if there's any lesson for American women right now from African women, it's go to the places that are informal.
Right, that's fascinating. That's really good advice for us. Although I probably could talk to you for hours about what we in the U.S. should do. And I think, you know, it's a really interesting question. I think many of us feel we're at a very, you know, unusual and strange moment in terms of the women's movement. And so your thoughts about that are really interesting, about the technical. So it's not just about pay equity or rights to birth control, for example, but these more sort of subtle issues around unconscious bias and gender discrimination. And we certainly saw this in the election against Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Before we move to the next question, is there anything else either of you would like to reflect on as it relates to our recent election?
Well, that would be a very long conversation, which may not be funded by the Aspen Institute.
Or anything related to this question of that it's not around the technical, but around these more subtle cultural issues related to women.
Yeah, I mean, I think the American election was a classic example of, in fact, not even subtle, of a sort of, one, the backlash that I referred to earlier, this idea that there is a certain permission to be rude, intolerant, and questioning of women's rights to be in public, to be unapologetic about themselves, to be the kind of woman that Hillary Clinton has been for, you know, 20, 30 years in the public eye, stern when she wants to be, laughing when she wants to be. So I think the tactic in the public discourse, the tactic that, you know, President-elect Trump, you know, used very effectively, was to kind of remove the mask of politeness and of civility, and to simply give permission to that backlash to say, we will question. So I think he represented something bigger than himself. Obviously, he did, because he won the election. But we will question the rights of women to be this way, to be different from the kinds of women who were around in the 1950s. So it definitely was startling, but also deeply troubling for those of us who have always looked to America as a place of political and democratic leadership, to see that kind of ripping into women, I think was very troubling.
Yeah. Joy, did you want to add anything to that point?
Yeah, I mean, what I would add is that, I mean, having gone into politics as a child, when, you know, I used to be the leader of the student movement at home when we were fighting for liberation in South Africa and in Rhodesia and in Namibia, Mozambique. I was president of the National Student Union, you know, from high school. My feeling is that the stereotyping of and setting the bar in terms of moral ethics much higher for women than for men, it has been there, and I think what the American election did was just, you know, proof. That, I mean, I was exposed to it from the moment I joined politics, particularly in my adult life now, not as a student politician. The bar is much higher for women in terms of what is ethically acceptable, what is morally acceptable, and also in terms of what you are able to deliver. I mean, a man can make a promise without substantiating it, whereas a woman has to substantiate it in order for people to see that a woman is capable of delivering. You know, you actually have to give evidence that you are able to deliver. Whereas with a man, that evidence is normally not required. And this is not peculiar to the U.S. It is the way that, politics has defined participation of women even in our societies. So my feeling is that women really have to wake up. I mean, even if we feel we don't owe it to ourselves, we owe it to our daughters. We have created a society. We women have participated in creating the society where standards for women are different than standards for men, where the road to success is paved for a man and is filled with barriers for a woman. So we the women, have to stand up and decide that we are going to redefine or recreate a road that is better for the girl child, for our girl children. Nobody is going to do it for us. And I think we embraced this challenge before, at the time of the women's movement. But somewhere along the line, we got lost. We have to re-find that courage and rediscover that struggle, because it has not been won at all.
You're listening to The Bridge from the Aspen Institute. I'm Peggy Clark. Today's guests are Joy Pumafi and Sisange Misimang, advocates for women and girls in Africa and across the world. Joy Pumafi chairs the Global Leaders Council for Reproductive Health at the Aspen Institute, and Sisange Misimang is a writer and directs the Center for Stories. Here's the rest of our conversation. So, you know, the Bridge podcast is founded on this idea that we have a lot to learn from each other across generations, and that we haven't really taken the time to ask these kinds of questions and listen. So every Bridge podcast, we ask both of you, what's one question you have for each other? And so, Sisange, what's one question that you have for Joy?
I guess I would ask, I mean, growing up, there are names that you hear all the time, and in this case, obviously, Joy Pumapi, Unity Dao, these were the kind of women whose names were in the air, who were achievers, who were kind of pioneers, and who in some ways made it possible for girls like me to emerge, because you could see that they were doing it. And so I guess the question that I have, and it really is an honor to be in conversation with someone whose name you've known growing up. So the question I would have is about whether there was a private or personal cost to the public stature that you achieved, and whether when you think about, you know, being a mother and, you know, raising a family. You know, one of the things I grapple with is, you know, how much do I be in the world and how much do I be there for my kids? And so I suppose that's the question that I would have for you.
That's an important question. It's very, very difficult to strike a balance. What I tried to do was wait until my kids were, you know, reasonably advanced before I went into active politics. I may not have timed it right, and we are aware that this is something that the man normally does not even have to think about, because he immediately assumes that the wife will stay at home and bring up the kids. So there is a price that you pay. All of the women that I was with in Parliament when I barring, of course, Dr. Hausiti Chepe, who was never married, you know, their marriages ended up collapsing, and primarily because they were in politics. So there is a price that you pay, but I think, again, this is a product of socialization, is the way that we have socialized ourselves and socialized our families, and made the process that much more difficult for the girl child. So yes, there is a price to pay. I choose to postpone my entry into politics until my kids were, you know, reasonably grown up. Not grown up, but, you know, at least finished a basic education. But, you know, and yet I still paid a price, even with that, you know, level of planning. So I would say for a woman, you have to decide which is the greater of the you know of the two goods that you can have. Unfortunately, it is unless if you are fortunate enough to have a partner who accepts equal responsibility as you for the you know bringing up with your children. So it is a difficult choice, and I do agree. But I'm hoping that our children, or at the very least our children's children, won't have to make that choice.
That's great, Joy. And Joy, what's one question that you'd like to ask Sasonke?
Yeah, I mean, I found your career development, Sasonke, pretty impressive, and I just want to congratulate you on what you have achieved. I know it cannot have been easy for you, but what I want to find out from you, since you are coming from one of our newest republics on the African continent. It's a new republic with a lot of challenges, and I mean, what only surprises me is that people, for some reason, expect it not to have challenges. And when South Africa has challenges, they, you know, people become very distraught. And forgetting that Rome was not built in a day. But I know that some of the challenges that you are facing in your country are pretty vexing for your generation and for the generation that comes behind you. But what I want to find out from you is, do you think at this stage, you know, the amount of progress that you've made in, you know, gender equity in politics, do you think you are on the right track, or do you think that there's something else that still needs to be done for you to get better equity in politics? Do you think, for example, somebody like Nkosasana Zuma, who is potentially a candidate for the next presidency, stands a good chance and a better chance than Hillary Clinton did, for example, in South Africa?
Yeah, that's a great question, which I, in some ways, anticipated. So I think that Nkosazana Zuma, were the decision to be made, were people to vote on the basis of merit, she would be one of our finest prospects for a new president. And I also think that given some of the trajectory of South African politics, the possibility of a woman president is not something that voters would reject out of hand. I think we have a history that allows people to at least consider that possibility. I think the reality, however, is so complicated by factors that aren't necessarily about gender, but are about, you know, the politics of the current president and all these other things. And so I'm not sure whether we will get a woman president this time around. Were the politics right in terms of the way succession should be happening within our ruling party? I think she would be in line, and we would be in line to have a woman president. That's been the talk, you know, amongst everybody. But I think what you're asking speaks to a larger question, which is very much, which was evident in the response that you gave to my question, which is about the experiences that women have had in parliament. After the first two sessions of parliament in the new South Africa, there was a dip in the number of women who were willing to return and serve as members of parliament because there were so many relationships that were difficult, because the climate and the environment is horrible. One of our angel heroes in South Africa is Thuli Madonsela, who has been the public protector. And she's this crime-busting, anti-corruption figure. She's amazing. She was profiled in Time magazine. And yet she has been subjected to the most horrible misogyny, insulted for her looks, simply because she dares to stand up against corruption. And so on the one hand, you have the possibility of a female president and a ruling party that has a history of respecting women, of passing legislation, as I pointed out earlier, which has been very much pro-women, of having many powerful women within its ranks, including the current chair of the African Union and now soon to be presidential candidate. And on the other hand, you have very bitter and difficult experiences of the women who have been at the forefront of activism and of politics in South Africa. So it goes back to this question I think we've talked about from the beginning of this conversation, which is it's never enough, that it is never enough, and yet that is not cause to give up hope. So you have to both recognize the real problems and challenges and then have the optimism and the wherewithal to continue to fight against those challenges. Because if you don't, then it just gets worse, which is not an option. So, yeah.
Excellent. Great, great answer. Wonderful. So we're coming to the end of our podcast, and we end each Bridge podcast episode with the same question of, to each of you, what is one hope you have for each other's generation? So, Joy, let me start with you. What is one hope that you have for Sasonke's generation?
Well, one hope that I have for Sasonke's generation, which is really, you know, the one immediately after mine, is that you achieve better than we did the social transformation that is required to make gender equity not only a reality, but a sustainable reality. That is my one hope for you, because we have not succeeded. I wouldn't say we have failed. There have been pockets of success, but we have not succeeded. That's my one hope for you.
Beautiful. And Sasonke, what's one hope that you have for Joy's generation?
So first, let me thank her for that hope, because that's a beautiful hope. And then let me say that I think my one hope for the generation immediately in front of me, is that they have an opportunity to rest. Because I think it's been a long fight, and you see many of them not giving up the fight and worrying very much that we are very busy with many, many things and can't take up the fight. And I think we are there to take up the fight. Not that we don't want and need their support, but I do hope for them that they can find moments to rest.
Beautiful. That's a great hope. I think, Joy, you're probably doing that right this moment, right? But not quite, because she's got grandmother or auntie duties, I think, grandmother duties. Yeah, is that right, Joy? You have to go pick them up from preschool, I think. I really want to say this has been an incredible, extraordinary conversation, and I'm really so grateful to both of you and appreciate the work that you do, and am honored to have you both in my life, and will take up arms and do whatever you tell me to do at any moment in time. So thank you so much for being with us. And I'd also like to thank all of you for listening to The Bridge today. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'm Peggy Clark, and thanks for listening.